Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. It is Tuesday, August 13th. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today we take a closer look at the Office of Hawaiian Affairs post-primary. With voter turnout so low this past weekend, what can we look forward to in the general election? Keeping a close eye on the health of our reefs, we look at research that's been underway off the coast of West Maui. We hear about workshops to learn how Native Hawaiians used to select names, what's in a name. And in a nod to the close of the Olympics in Paris, we honohoe a conversation that we had about Hawaii sport, surfing. The conversation starts right after the latest local and national headlines. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hard to believe, but it's been about 24 years since elections for OHA, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, was open to all registered voters and not just Hawaiians. That practice was found to be unconstitutional back in 2000. But today, many voters are unfamiliar with the names on the ballots when election time comes around. As a result, oftentimes candidates whose names are familiar tend to get the most votes. Here to talk about the OHA races is HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what did we see this year?
I mean, there was really no surprise. What we saw this year compared to previous elections is basically the same. It's just we saw name recognition played a key factor in the voters' decision in picking these candidates for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. We also saw, and this is an inside joke that that was brought up to me by a political observer, is that if your last name starts with the A, if you're at the top of the alphabet, you have a higher chance of getting into the Office of Hawaiian Affairs or moving on to the general election. So that's what we saw. So for example, we're going to see the return of a former congressman, Kai Kahele, who won outright for the Hawaii Island seat. And that was an open race because incumbent Mililani Trask did not seek re-election. And then Kai Kahele, if we're looking at the votes, he got 29.5%, and he was going up against Zuri Aki. I believe he worked for OHA at the time, Hope Alohalani Kermel, and, you know, they didn't garner enough votes, and he won outright, and in the elections, you have to win more than half the percent of the vote in order to win outright. And then for the Molokai seat, we have incumbent Luana Alapa, who is going to be facing Kunani Nihipali in the general election for November. And Luana Alapa, she has name recognition. She is the former Miss Hawaii pageant. And then the at-large seat was actually really interesting. That was the most crowded race. We saw that seven candidates were going to face off incumbent Kaili'i Akina, and he secured a little over 15% of the vote. What's also interesting about this race, it's the most competitive. So we saw actually three former OHA trustees that were putting up a bid to go up against Kaili'i Akina. So we saw Leahu Isa, who came in second, Peter Apo, Brendan Kale'aina Lee, and three other candidates trail behind. But you kind of see the alphabetical order of what we're seeing at the at-large race. But for sure, for the at-large trustee seat, Kaili'i Akina will be facing Leahu Isa in the general in November. And then for the Kauai seat, Dana Huna, who's the incumbent, will face Laura Lindsay. But since there was already two, they're already going to advance to the general election anyway. So when I spoke with Jacob Aki, he's the president of the Oahu Council of the Association of Hawaiian Civics Club. He says candidates need to be strategic when they're running for OHA because it is a statewide race and they're going up against well-known incumbents. So basically he's saying you have to spend money in order to get your name out there, especially if you're not that well-known. He used the at-large race as an example.
Most people don't pay attention to the politics of the agency. Most people aren't even familiar with who the trustees are. So when it comes to campaigning and when it comes to trying to garner votes, name recognition is oftentimes what's going to put you at the top of the ballot. And that's what we saw in this race. Obviously, Keli'i Akina, you know, he spent the most and he raised the most money. He raised over $60,000 this cycle, spent about $50,000. And he had his signs up on every single island. As I went across the state over the past several months, his signs were everywhere. So the more signs you get up, the more you can increase your name recognition, the better chance you have at winning this seat or at least making it onto the general. I think what we also saw was Lei Ahuisa, who's a former OHA trustee and a former Board of Education member. She came in second. When you look at the island breakout, at least for the at-large seat, Keli'i Akina fared pretty well, but Lei Ahuisa was right behind him. It's hard. You know, for most of the candidates running in this race, they're not going to raise a lot of money. So they're really going to rely on their name recognition. So at least for the at-large seat, that's kind of what we saw, and that's what I think voters saw.
Yeah, we should probably mention, you know, Lei Ahuisa was also a state lawmaker, same with Peter Apoh, you know, so yeah, they're already, you know, known to a lot of older voters.
Yeah, and they come with a lot of experience too, so it's going to be really interesting when we see the general election and the outcome of that. But Jacob Aki brought up a really good point about, you know, you have to spend money in order to get your name out there. For example, when I was looking at the campaign spending reports, Kai Kahele, for example, he spent more than $5,000 to get his campaigning out there, his website, get the banners up. So you saw a little bit of that. But when you think about it, $5,000, a little bit over $5,000 is really not that much. So he really banked off his name in order to get in. And while other candidates, you know, there's a checkbox where it says, like, I'm not going to spend $1,000 or less, something like that. And then same thing for Keli'i Akina. Like, he spent and raised a lot of money, too. And then Lei Ahuisa really also didn't spend that much money. But you did see some banners, especially on Oahu. I saw some of her banners around the Punch Bowl neighborhood, for example. But when we saw the voter turnout, we know that it's pretty low this election season. When I looked at the printout, the voter turnout, there was 269,000 total for the turnout. But when you compare it to OHA, OHA also has a pretty low voter turnout as well. And for the at-large race, just to compare, more than 151,000 voters voted for that at-large race. So that's kind of like a stark comparison, for example, of that.
Yeah, and I'm sure people who just weren't familiar with the candidates and didn't take the time to do the research probably left the ballots blank.
Yeah, and Jacob Aki, he also brought up that even though that anyone can vote for OHA, it's a statewide race, it's kind of a mixed bag. So for example, some of his friends who are non-Native Hawaiian would ask him, like, who do I vote for? Like, what are the issues? And then it's basically up to Jacob Aki and other people who pay attention to OHA to help educate them. And then another feeling is, like, if you're non-Native Hawaiian, maybe you might feel that, oh, maybe it doesn't feel right voting for OHA. Or maybe, like, some people who just moved here, but they have residency and they can vote, maybe they don't feel the need to vote because they don't feel that they know the issues well enough. Jacob also did bring up an important point that it is important for OHA to get more of the information out there. You know, maybe some people may not feel comfortable voting for OHA, or others may feel that they lost the trust in the state agency.
I think it's very exciting to see. You know, it'll be exciting to see the new CEO, who herself has worked at the legislature for a really long time, seeing some of the new leaders that they have really engaged, whether it's at the ledge, whether it's in the community, whether it's at a national level, to really advance the interests of the Native Hawaiian community. But I will say that OHA does have a PR problem. OHA has had a PR problem for a very long time, you know, and those several years in which, you know, they've had negative headlines relating to mismanagement of trust funds, controversies regarding previous trustees. They really lost a lot of the trust in both the Native Hawaiian community and I think, you know, within, you know, other key stakeholders as well. So I think OHA really has a lot of work to do to restore that trust, but to also fix the PR problem that they have, you know, and to really let the community know that OHA is learning from those mistakes, you know, and that they really are working to advance the interests of the Native Hawaiian community. And that kind of work really takes time. But as I keep saying, I think with the new leadership and the direction that I think the current CEO is going to take the agency, I'm very hopeful, you know, that we're going to start to see more good things coming out of the agency.
Yeah, and, you know, we should remind people that OHA is in charge of hundreds of millions of dollars, right? And they're really focused on, you know, helping Native Hawaiians.
Yeah, and that's part of their job, too. And also, I know it's a more than $500 million trust fund so far that they're managing.
Yeah, lots at stake. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thank you.
That was HVR's Cassie Ordonio talking to us about the OHA elections. Voters are encouraged to learn about the candidates before the general election. Check out the OHA website and the Honolulu Star Advertiser in Silla Beach to learn more about their positions on key issues.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Aloha, this is Bert Lum, host of Bite Marks Cafe. The show has moved to a new day and time, Fridays at 6:30 p.m. on HPR 1. Join us as we showcase the creativity and innovation in Hawaii's tech community. Download past episodes of Bite Marks Cafe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the free HBR app. Bite Marks Cafe, now on Fridays at 6:30 p.m. on HBR 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Telcom, now offering Fioptics Plus TV service statewide, giving neighbor island families a choice in TV providers. HawaiianTel.com/Fioptics Plus.
There's a new study out on coral bleaching that looked at reefs in Leeward, Maui from 2014 to 2021 with some good news. The study monitored thousands of corals, charting their growth and survival after two major bleaching events. It was to create what was called a time series. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to two of the researchers behind this new study, Orion McCarthy, who's with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and Morgan Pomeroy, who's with the University of Hawaii. McCarthy also recently returned to West Maui to monitor any effects that last year's fire may have had on the conditions of the reef off Lahaina.
The real focus of this study was to be able to look between two bleaching events and to see how those impacts compare, because we were fortunate enough to be able to visit reefs during both of those bleaching events at the peak of heat stress. So it creates this really interesting case study in how multiple back-to-back bleaching events impact coral reefs. Basically, the time series allowed us to follow these individuals through time. And if for people that aren't used to thinking about corals as individuals, you can think of just a population of people as a way to think about it more easily, and maybe think about it with pandemics is like the way I like to describe it to people who aren't used to thinking about bleaching. Like if you could think about COVID-19 and it impacting a population, some people get sick and some people don't get sick. And then if you have multiple pandemics, you could look, if it hits the same group of people, you could see, well, did these people get sick two times in a row? Did some people get sick the first time and not the next time? Did some people never get sick? And that's basically what we were able to do, but with coral bleaching on a reef, and to see if corals were able to bleach and then recover and survive till the next bleaching event and then bleach again and recover again, or if some corals sailed right through and didn't bleach at all. So it really allowed us to look at a population level, but also to follow these individuals through time and to connect that bleaching response to other things like growth. And we actually, it was really interesting, we saw that for corals that survived the entire time series and survived both bleaching events, that there wasn't a difference for most of the species between corals that bleached and corals that didn't bleach in terms of how they grew. So that was really surprising that you can have, we really expected to see that the impact of bleaching would have these lingering effects and cause corals to have reduced growth and partial mortality. And while that was the case for some taxa, for the most part, it seemed like it was not a significant impact from bleaching on long-term growth for corals that survived the whole time.
Yeah, and I can also say that with the work that I've been leading, where we were looking at trends across the main Hawaiian islands, not simply corals on Maui, we saw this trend repeated again, where we were seeing that colonies that survived the 2019 bleaching event, we didn't see any effect of that bleaching on short-term growth in our colony. So it was cool for Orion and I, and affirming to see that trend repeating.
Yeah, that was one of the parts of the study that really stuck out to me, both the just time scale that you were able to look at things on, that we're not talking about one bleaching event, but really multiple that happened over a 7-year period, I believe. But then also just the sheer number of corals that you looked at, almost 2,000, right? And that must have been an undertaking.
A labor of love. Yeah, Morgan and I both became experts at trying to determine what is the boundary of an individual coral, and spending a lot of time staring at the computer screen, tracing things, looking at things in 3D and 2D, and lots of Zoom calls to work out various questions. So we definitely, even though I don't think we've ever actually met in person, we've spent a lot of time together.
Yeah. We're online friends.
What was some of the field work like?
Yeah, there's slightly different approaches, but generally we're trying to take as many pictures as we can of a reef, usually about the size of like the first floor of a house or something, 100 square meters. The main goal is to get lots of overlap between pictures, because if you get that overlap, then an algorithm called structure from motion can use the overlap to stitch the images together into a 3D model. So the better overlap you have, the more complete sort of 3D model you're going to get. And then in just a little bit under an hour, you can do a scuba dive, collect all these images, and then you have this digital archive of the reef that you can spend countless hours, as both Morgan and I know, interrogating it, getting data from it, and then comparing it to other points in time. So it's this really powerful way of being able to take a deep dive, so to speak, into different aspects of reef health and ecology without having to spend countless hours underwater, which can be really constraining from a fieldwork perspective.
And you guys were visiting those reefs on Maui about once a year to collect the imagery that was used in the study.
The results that you present on growth and bleaching lead to a pretty interesting set of recommendations for conservation. And what were some of those recommendations?
I mentioned earlier that we didn't find a strong relationship between the bleaching history of a coral and the coral's growth in the future. And that's important because a lot of restoration efforts are really focused on trying to find these really thermally tolerant corals that can survive bleaching and using those as sort of seed corals for restoration efforts. And there's lots of reasons why that's a good idea, because if you spend all that time and effort doing restoration, you obviously want it to be effective and you don't want to lose all those corals to a future heat wave. But like anything in ecology, there can be trade-offs. So a coral that is thermally tolerant and doesn't bleach might also not grow as fast during non-bleaching years. So you might inadvertently create a reef that has less diversity and less adaptability for things other than bleaching, because reefs, of course, face a lot of different stressors. And I think one of the cool things about our study is that it's a natural experiment out in the field where these reefs are experiencing all sorts of different things in addition to the two bleaching events. And so it's a really good test of what an actual reef environment is like. And the fact that we're able to see these corals persist. One thing that we saw was that the larger colonies that had been around on the reef for a long time, the fact that they are large and have reached a certain size suggests that they have staying power on the reef, and they've been able to survive those two bleaching events plus lots of other disturbances since before we were even monitoring if they're going to be out on the reef at such a large size. And so sort of looking for colonies that have evidence of being around for a long time rather than sort of trying to just find colonies that don't have a bleaching history would be our recommendation, is to focus specifically on those corals that have a proven track record of being able to persist.
The power of this type of work is that we can actually, for each of the individual species of coral that we looked at, we can advise actual size thresholds for where we see the highest likelihood of survival after bleaching. So we can actually go out and say colonies of this size for this type of coral are what should be targeted when we're doing a restoration effort.
Orion, you were on Maui recently to do one of those annual surveys.
Yeah. Sort of, it was a multiple goals to this most recent trip, one of which was to continue our time series. And the other was to fill in some of the gaps of our time series. We unfortunately didn't have a really high coverage of sites just offshore of Lahaina. I think our closest site was at Wahakuli and Olawalu. So there's a sizable chunk of reef near Lahaina that we didn't have good coverage of. So this time we made sure to look at a map of prior coral cover data where other groups had gone collected, not necessarily 3D models, but had some knowledge of what the coral cover should look like. And then we dove at those coordinates and we collected imagery to create new 3D models so that we have some sort of baseline to compare to before the Lahaina fire. But this can mark a nearly 1 year post-fire benchmark of what reefs look like. And just sort of, we haven't had time to actually crunch the numbers and get hard data out of it, but just from initial observations, the coral cover looked pretty comparable to that pre-existing baseline data we had access to. And the reefs didn't look any different health-wise from elsewhere in Maui. So to me, that's encouraging. Not to say that there is no impact, because it's definitely too early to say that definitively. But I think there has been no large-scale die-off that some people were fearing. And I think that it will be extremely important to continue monitoring these reefs in the future, because a lot of the longer-term impacts, such as from toxic runoff or when Lahaina rebuilds, any impact from development, those sorts of impacts will take years, if not decades, to really manifest. But it's really important that we are watching so that we can detect those impacts, because people recreate in these waters, they eat fish that are caught in these waters, they are living right next to this ecosystem and are intimately connected to it. And so we need to continue to make use of this monitoring technology and this data set to inform approaches going forward and to serve as an early warning signal if something is to occur. I have just one other note to add, because I know that whenever there's like positive coral reef stories that come out, it can be a little bit confusing, because so much of the rest of the news around coral reefs is really negative, to the point that I get people who ask sometimes, why are you even studying coral reefs? Aren't they already dead? Isn't it sort of a foregone conclusion? And I think we have to thread the needle here between the overarching message that coral reefs are threatened and we need global climate action to address that, but also not throwing up our hands and seeing it as a foregone conclusion and realizing that there are ways we can adjust, especially local level management, especially in the state of Hawaii, to reduce those local human impacts that are threatening reefs and making it harder for them to survive a bleaching event. And so I think the message needs to be that reefs are in jeopardy, but there is action that can be taken to make sure that they stick around for us and for future generations. And this study is showing how climate change is transforming reefs, is weeding out certain individuals and leaving behind a reef that might be a little bit more stable because it's composed of survivors, but it does have, it's lost something. It has less diversity. And we will continue studying that and tracking the impacts of that. And as we do that, it would be great if everyone else who cares about reefs out there is advocating for policies that are going to help improve the health of the nearshore environment and ensure that coral reefs persist for years and decades to come.
That was such a great point, Orion. I'm so glad you said that. Because we really do have this future that's increasingly dominated by doom and gloom for coral reefs, but some of the work that we've done has shown these bright spots of hope. And I would also like to share encouraging news, and it's that while we've been seeing the global community going through record levels of heat stress and coral bleaching events both last year and this year, Hawaii has surprisingly avoided these bleaching events. So although it's not a question of if Hawaii will see further bleaching events, it's more of a question of when, I'm still encouraged by the fact that we have avoided it this year and last year. That's, you know, it's some good news.
We've been hearing from researchers Morgan Pomeroy and Orion McCarthy. They were talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Their new study was published recently in the journal Public Library of Science One. We'll have a link to it on the conversation page of our website after the show. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Oni ho, ole hua, oni hau, o kaua, o ahu, o molokai, o lanai, o maui, o kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
We have a statehood themed backyard quiz for you today because this Friday is Admissions Day. It will mark 65 years since Hawaii was admitted as the 50th state of the United States. The process formally began months earlier in March when President Dwight Eisenhower signed the Hawaii Admission Act. It was then put to a vote. Did residents want to join the Union or remain a territory? 132,000 people voted in favor of joining the United States, compared to around 8,000 votes against it. Celebrations were held at the state capitol and Iolani Palace for the occasion, and there was even an international statehood bonfire site with wood from around the world. But 1959 was not the first time that Hawaii statehood came up before the U.S. Congress. Our question for you, what year did lawmakers introduce the first statehood bill for Hawaii to Congress? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
The arrival of the Hawaiian language in recent decades has given many the opportunity to look closer at language-related traditions, like the tradition of giving Hawaiian names. In Hawaiian culture, names are believed to be representative of a person's spirit and could shape their path in life. Maluhia States is a Kauai resident who became fluent in Hawaiian as an adult. He also teaches language classes on his website, Ka'alala. This week, he's offering workshops on the Hawaiian naming tradition. The Conversations Plus a Subiono got the chance to talk to him this morning about why Hawaiians believe giving Hawaiian names is sacred.
Why is it important for both people outside of Hawaii and people of Hawaiian ancestry to understand this tradition?
Oh, there's a lot to tackle with that one. If you're Hawaiian, I mean, we grew up not knowing much, and I think a lot of us understand why, and the history has a lot to do with that. Yeah, I guess some words that come to mind are things like respect and being knowledgeable, not being ignorant about things. You know, a lot of issues arise amongst Kanaka and non-Kanaka because of just the ignorance of not knowing, especially when we talk about culture, because we understand the Western culture as Hawaiians really well. It's the Western culture that doesn't understand us very well. And I think another thing that I'll talk about in my workshop is reverence. There's really no, like, people don't hold things sacred anymore. And when names have always been talked about in my family, this is a sacred practice, and your name is something that we value and we cherish. And that's not something we can say for the Western world, right? I think we've all heard of stories where, oh, how did you get your name? I don't know, my dad was reading the newspaper, and this guy's name was Jason, and he thought he liked it, and there you go. You know, dad's George the Third because three generations ago, great-great-grandpa or whatever was George. So there you go. You know, there's not too much thought that goes into it, and a name is just something we call you, and that's about it. And I don't think anybody wants to be ignorant or prides themselves on being ignorant. So I'd assume that people would want to know, you know?
And it's not something that there's a whole lot of books on, or not something that there's a whole lot of classes or videos on.
I can say to that, there's probably not a lot of information because it's a sacred practice. Hawaiians traditionally are very spiritual people, you know, and so there's a lot of reverence that is called into play with anything spiritual, and names were often received, yeah, through that lens. So I think, although there is a very rich culture behind giving names, I don't think it was something that many of them would have talked about openly. And also, in some of the kupuna I've talked to and people in my family, and there's at least one source that talks about Hawaiians being very protective of their names. And so sometimes they'd only say part of their name so that you wouldn't get their full name, so that people couldn't potentially take it or, you know, misuse it or change it and give it to somebody else, if that makes sense.
What is the right way, or what's the right way to do it today?
I'm not sure I would say that there's just a one way or just the right way. It's a lot more difficult today, I would say, to get a name that's grammatically sound, based in a Hawaiian perspective, or has cultural nuance to it, just because of the lack of knowledge about the language itself. That makes it really difficult. In fact, I've had experiences over time where people will be like, here's the name I was given. Is this okay? Or what do you think about that? Some of them are blatantly grammatically unsound, yeah, which you wouldn't find among native speakers. It's not something that happens. That's a result of where people that had our culture and our language oppressed. And so we're digging in dictionaries and kind of think this is how it might go, but we're not sure. The right way, I think a lot of people nowadays are kind of pulling multiple parties on board to get a name, kind of to just, because not everybody can speak the language or not at all, so everybody jumps on with the knowledge that they have, or they use the dictionary heavily, and then you guys all work together to figure it out. That is definitely a way that most people are probably doing it, most Hawaiians.
Yeah,
a lot of dictionary reliance, a lot of dictionary knowledge. The reason that that's problematic, though, is the dictionary, if we're talking about Mary Kawenapuku'i's dictionary, the big one, the dictionary, it doesn't always elaborate or distinguish terms. So if you look up a word like smell, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of words, literally, if you go look at it. So some people kind of chalked it up to, these are all synonymous. I can just pick any one that I want. But that's not how it works. And so there's been some funny names that come out that way because they're just not sure. I want to say this too. Although I know the language now and I have a lot more knowledge base now, this was not always the case. I'm just like every modern day Hawaiian. I did not grow up with the language. I didn't know like any of the practices. I just had fragments of bits and pieces that were left behind. The knowledge that I have about names, my family actually has a lot of stories, good and bad, about names. And there is a culture that was maintained up to a certain point. And then it was all just kind of done away with. But as I've been preparing for this specific workshop, I've talked to a lot of family members and gotten stories. Some of the stories I thought was about somebody else. And I felt so embarrassed that it was actually about us. I was like, I remember that embarrassing story. They're like, oh, that was about so-and-so. I was like, no. And they're like, yeah, that's our family. And so, you know, I'm just as much a work in progress as any Hawaiian out there. I just happen to have a really strong command of the language now.
I did want to talk a little bit about the workshops that you are giving. Can you kind of share maybe a summary or a short rundown of the things that people can expect to learn in your workshops?
Yeah, the layout is going to be talking about traditions, how names were received. There's many different ways that have been recorded. Some have been documented. Others, like I said, I've received in my own family and I've talked to other Hawaiian families. Some of them are similar and shared. Once in a while, there's a very rare way that a name was received or given. I'll talk about my own family, some examples from my own family. And that's to kind of, you know, exemplify what to do and what not to do. So I'll use my own name also as an example. So my name's slightly grammatically unsound, which I didn't find out till I could speak the language. Uh-huh. I actually thought about changing my name because of that. And then I, you know, over the years, as I've thought about it, I realized that it doesn't have any negative, extremely negative connotations, which would have been a really good reason to change it. And some other names are the opposite, where they're really negative connotations and you'd want to get rid of that. Just because you would want, you know, the best for the person who receives the name. The misuse of language, I wish it was only found among non-Hawaiians, but that's not the case. There's actually a lot of organizations where they'll use an English word and then a Hawaiian word, and then they'll take away parts of the Hawaiian word. So then it's just gibberish. It's not Hawaiian anymore. So that, in linguistics, as I've talked to friends over the years, is called language corruption or the bastardization of a language. You're degrading the language, and actually you're degrading both, because, you know, all of these letters represent a word, represent meaning, represent nuances in that culture that that word belongs to, for both the English and then also on the Hawaiian side. So both languages are degraded to serve the purpose of just a name that an organization is going to be called by. After all that, it seems kind of doom and gloom. So what I typically do at the end is give them advice. If you don't have a command of the language, I don't recommend trying to come up with a name, because one, it's just English to Hawaiian, the grammar is really different. And so a lot of the times names nowadays, the organization of the Hawaiian is following English, but then it makes no sense in Hawaiian. And that, I think, goes back to that no reverence and not holding anything sacred anymore. At the end of it, it's one of the more important parts of, okay, you guys are looking for names, or at some point you will. My suggestions are learn Hawaiian. And then when you are competent enough, then you could give a name that would make sense, at the very least. Learning Hawaiian also, outside of just, you know, organization and the choice of words, you'll learn, hopefully, some terms have negative connotations, and you don't want to put that on a child. Or some of them are really heavy to bear, and we also don't put that on them. And that's something that the family would decide. Some names are strong, but these words, you see, I think one thing I just talk about at the end is just that, you know, your friend Michael, that's just his name. That's just what he's called by. He doesn't know if it means anything. At some point, it did mean something in some other language, but nobody knows what that is. It's just something he's called by. But when you call a person by their name in Hawaiian, it further enforces whatever that word is and what it means. It's the same with if you call your child stupid enough, it has an effect on that child. You know, if you call them smart, it has an effect on them. And everybody, I think, would agree on that. It's the same for a name. So if you call them, you know, if their name is Maruhia, you know, peaceful, if you call them Ikaika, strength, and that can be physical, mental, and others, you know, those qualities are reinforced every time that child's name is called. So you have to know these terms. You have to know the nuances that come about in the culture. And you have to know that, I mean, for Hawaiians, it's not superstition. In fact, there's no word for Hawaiian in superstition. And so what it is our spiritual belief, and all of that has power to it. We give these words power, you know, the Hawaiian culture and the people did before us. You know, we're just coming into it. So the suggestion of learning Hawaiian is one I push really hard for Hawaiians. Learn it. Take time to learn it. If you're not going to, then find a family member or a friend that can help you. Somebody who's competent in the language. The only drawback on that one is if you don't know the language, you can't know if they're competent or not.
Right.
And then the other option would be to come to me, somebody like me. Yeah, those are kind of the options I give them.
Maluhia, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That was Hawaiian language teacher and social media influencer of Maluhia States, talking with HBR's Russell Subiono. States workshops on the Hawaiian naming tradition are being held on August 15th at the Vaivai Collective's Kaneohe location and online on August 17th. We'll have a link to more information on our website later today.
You are invited to HPR Generation Listens Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and connect with fellow HPR fans. Gather your team of up to 6 public radio nerds and sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
When you support HPR, you help shine the spotlight on Hawaii's next generation of musicians.
How long have you been playing the violin?
I've been playing for about 7 years. I got my violin for Christmas when I was 6, and then I started playing probably a month after.
Hear from local students every Tuesday on HPR2's Classical Pacific.
I'd say just number one thing for really any musician, but even percussionists too, it's really just all about persistence and exactness. There will be times where, you know, you kind of get down about it, but there's always a light around the corner.
Help HPR uplift Hawaii's youngest musicians. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you how residents of Hawaii reacted to statehood 65 years ago, but there was also a long and contentious history behind stitching Hawaii on as the 50th star on the Union flag. Nearly 2 decades after the overthrow of Queen Liliuokalani, Prince Jonah Kuhio introduced the first bill for statehood. He was serving as a non-voting member of Congress to represent the territory of Hawaii and put forward the bill to improve the living conditions of Native Hawaiians. Around this time, an article in the Washington Post stated that the movement was not a whoop statehood, but for justice. Prince Kuhio's bill died in committee, but bills for Hawaii statehood were reintroduced 48 times in the following year. We were looking for the year that Prince Kuhio introduced that first statehood bill. The answer, 1919. We stumped you on that one. But that's our quiz for today. If you have an idea for one to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. The 2024 Olympics are over, and although Hawaii's Carissa Moore did not medal in women's surfing this time, Kauai resident Tatiana Weston Webb did take home silver while representing Brazil. Winning an Olympic medal is a dream that many local surfer girls can aspire to now. It could be a goal of those featured in the Amazon Prime Video documentary series Surf Girls Hawaii. Monica Medellin is the creator and executive producer of the series. It focuses on up-and-coming Native Hawaiian surfers like Moana Jones-Wong, Maluhia Kinimaka, and Brianna Cope. Medellin talked to former HPR producer Stephanie Hahn last year about how she learned to surf as a young girl and her mission to tell stories about women of color in sports.
Surf Girls is what I dreamt of watching when I was a little girl. We've seen Blue Crush, which was released in 2002, which was one of my favorite films. And I really identified with Michelle Rodriguez's character, who was another Latina. And I think, you know, what inspired Surf Girls is I felt like it was time for more films to be reflective of the reality of the history of surfing, which is that surfing was started by Indigenous people of color and Hawaiians. So Surf Girls puts the female Native Hawaiian experience at the forefront, and I hope that it inspires more narratives that center these types of stories.
What is it that you're thinking might be gained from the presence of Native Hawaiian women and a pivot back to understanding the history?
When I worked in the surf industry, I noticed that major mainstream platforms were promoting coverage of male surfers and barely any of women and female surfers. And in advertisements to this day, it's still common to see a female surfer posing in a bikini on the beach with a male surfer surfing a wave next to that imagery. So I started a personal archive of my favorite female surfers who I thought deserved the spotlight. And through this research and digging and connecting with people in my network, I found the Surf Girls Hawaii cast. These young women are redefining the culture around surfing and elevating women's sports through surfing. And I'm so happy to see these young women be acknowledged for their skill and just to know that the future of our world and the sport is in the hands of this next generation.
And what do you feel is different about what they're bringing to the sport? There's something else that's coming with their presence as young Native Hawaiian women.
This show is about young women coming of age and navigating life and growing into who they are. And it just so happens that they are among the best surfers in the world. And a lot of them are actually at a crossroads of wanting a major surfing career, but not wanting to miss out on all that life has to offer. And there are a lot of personal sacrifices necessary to realize these dreams. And it's actually their close-knit support system and sisterhood that helps them get through it. So I think what makes this cast and these surfers different is the fact that they're actually multifaceted and multidimensional women.
What was interesting to me was this idea of everyone supporting each other, but they're all chasing a very similar type of dream. And what that means to be in, let's say, competition with the self, but also in healthy competition with one's peers and elevating an idea of sisterhood. So I thought that was very well done.
Thank you. It was really important to have stakes in documentary filmmaking. You need that to help push the story and help your audience root for your characters or the cast, or in our case, for our surf girls. But what I didn't want was cattiness and drama between the girls to serve as those stakes. The stakes were already prevalent without that. The stakes are actually really high, and they're much higher because these women are Native Hawaiian competitive surfers. There's a lot on the line, and this competition and these results are much more than a personal dream. This is uplifting their entire community and Native Hawaiian voices in a professional sport that doesn't have much representation. So those stakes are very clear and have always been very clear to me. And I'm so happy that that resonated with people, because oftentimes when you see a show that centers a group of women, you see this fabricated drama and mean-spirited, you know, energy between the women. And that's exactly the opposite of what Surf Girls Hawaii is.
Right. I definitely saw that. Are you of Native Hawaiian descent? And if so, tell me about that journey to surfing. And if not, also tell me about surfing and how you came to then do this series highlighting this group.
First of all, I think it's really rare to see somebody like me creating a show and executive producing a show. I'm an Indigenous woman of color of Mexican descent, and I identify as Indigenous Latina. So that's something very special about this project, is that behind the lens, you have women that represent this diversity and are reflective of the stories being told in front of the camera. We share our Indigenous identity, and I see myself in them. And I feel like it was easy to relate with me and build trust and create a show that feels authentic and nuanced because of that shared experience. My personal mission is to promote diversity and representation in front of the camera, but also behind the lens. And my work primarily focuses on expanding narratives around women and people of color in sports. I've been an athlete since I was a little girl, but surfing wasn't an obvious choice for me. My mom is an immigrant from Mexico, a single working mom who is a public school teacher and who worked very hard every day to make ends meet. But she wanted me to have every opportunity for success. So she sought out scholarships and sports camps and after school programs and extracurricular activities. And it started with more traditional sports like basketball and volleyball. Then I moved to gymnastics, and then we discovered surfing. And I fell in love immediately and was basically doing headstands on my board by the time I was 12 because of my gymnastics experience. And
wow,
I feel like I've been a surfer girl ever since. And I think what's interesting is growing up going to surf camp in Los Angeles, I never felt like I belonged. I always felt like an outsider, and there was nobody that looked like me in the programs and the camps at the beach. I didn't know this history of surfing at the time, and I imagine what my world would have been if Surf Girls Hawaii existed at that point. It wasn't until college that I met another Indigenous Latina surfer who shared this deep history of Native Hawaiian women leading the lineups and Hawaiian surf history and everything that I didn't know previously. And that changed my whole world. So my mission to make Surf Girls Hawaii started at that point. I don't want any young person to grow up without knowing this rich, deep history that changed my life. And I really hope that Surf Girls Hawaii does that. I pinch myself every day that I made this and can hopefully inspire and influence more stories like this to be told on large-scale platforms. So another thing that was really important to me throughout this process is collaborating with Native Hawaiian creatives behind the camera. Our underwater director of photography, Matt Hirakuji, is a Native Hawaiian waterman and cinematographer. So I think through these collaborations and this intentional partnership and friendship, it represents that raw, authentic feeling.
I think you did a great job. Thank you so much, Monica. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Stephanie.
That was Monica Medellin, the creator and executive director of Surf Girls Hawaii, an Amazon Prime Video 4-part documentary series about up-and-coming Native Hawaiian surfers. Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we learn about efforts to recycle solar panels now that the push for rooftop systems are in high gear. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Google, Apple, or Spotify, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.